Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning, it's August 24th. Currently 63 degrees here in Old Town Park City. A few clouds outside our weather window here in Old Town Park City. 64 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're going to be looking at partly cloudy skies as we go throughout your Monday. We'll have a chance of those isolated thunderstorms developing this afternoon, maybe a slightly better chance as we head into the evening hours. Now, one or two of those storms could get a little feisty like we've seen the past couple of days with those wind gusts up to 50 to 60 miles per hour and that potential of some frequent cloud-to-ground lightning. So we're going to be keeping a close eye on that for you, particularly as we head into the early evening hours. Now, as we go into your Tuesday, I think we'll still have a chance of a pop-up storm, but I think it will really be confined to the higher elevations. High temperatures will be in the mid-80s for us both for today and for your Tuesday afternoon in the Park City area. We'll be seeing those temperatures right around 90 both today and tomorrow for us in the Heber Valley. As we head into the middle of the week, we're looking at partly cloudy skies. Again, just a pop-up storm possible in the higher elevations. Highs will be in the mid-80s on your Wednesday. In Park City, we'll see those highs in the lower 90s as we get you into the Heber Valley. As we move into your Thursday, look for partly cloudy skies out there. There's a chance of another surge of moisture trying to sneak back into the area. I think better chances of that will occur for your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So we'll have to bump up the rain chances just a little bit again as we head into the upcoming weekend. But overall, I would expect partly cloudy skies with a chance of a few more isolated storms returning again for your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday afternoons. Again, by no means a washout, but looks like we will have to add in a little extra moisture, particularly as we get into the weekend time frame for that chance of those pop-up showers and storms. And once again, if those are slow-moving storms with some heavy rainfall, that could lead to some isolated flash flooding along with that threat of frequent cloud-to-ground lightning. So stay weather aware as we head into the weekend. Of course, we'll fine-tune that as we get closer. But for the next couple of days, watch out for a few of those afternoon and evening pop-up storms. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Jordan Clayton. He is the data collection officer and supervisor for the Utah Snow Survey. I'll be taking a look at Utah's water sources. Park City Chamber Bureau CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff with a monthly update on lodging and taxes, and Utah Valley University professor, podcaster, and author Greg Jackson. He'll be a part of a Song Summit panel on how to find a path forward with civility. Taking a look at some local news now, the Park City Council reviewed concepts to redevelop Main Street and Sweet Alley last week. KPCW's Christine Weller reports it's prioritizing the aging China Bridge parking garage.
Main Street and Sweet Alley redevelopment discussions returned to the Park City Council Thursday for the first time since February 2025. The concepts were previously part of the Main Street area plan, but the council did not adopt the proposal in December 2024, instead taking a piecemeal approach by prioritizing specific elements and checking their feasibility. The traffic and circulation improvement feasibility studies are now largely complete, and city staff presented their findings. One feasibility study looked into a more pedestrian-friendly Main Street and Sweet Alley. The latest Main Street concept design includes an 8-foot-wide sidewalk on one side and a 14-foot path on the other. It also features an 8-foot-wide parking zone and one-way travel for cars, while the trolley could travel up and down Main Street. City Economic Development Project Manager Matt Lee said the design includes landscaping.
Street furnishings and trees would be robust enough to provide protection from vehicles, yet movable to allow the city to flex the right-of-way for street events while meeting public safety access requirements.
The Sweet Alley concept includes 6-foot sidewalks, a 9-foot parking zone, 2-way traffic lanes, and a 10-foot multi-use lane for service vehicles. The pedestrian-friendly redesign for both streets would cost about $36.6 million. The council said it supports the redevelopment's direction so far. Councilmember Bill Sirocco suggested the redevelopments start on Sweet Alley to limit impacts to Main Street businesses. Councilmember Tana Tolley said she wants Sweet Alley on par with Main Street.
Right now, our code actually says that Sweet Alley should be subordinate to Main Street. And to me, that is something that needs to just change dramatically, is we need to make it a place where it is a desirable area.
Previous Sweet Alley concepts added various businesses to entice visitors. The council agreed China Bridge is the top priority. The southern portion of the garage has 5 to 10 years of life left. The council wants to determine its future before the 2034 Olympics. A replacement or redevelopment of China Bridge would go hand in hand with aerial transit. Council supported adding a gondola connecting Main Street to Deer Valley Resort's Snow Park Village. Sirocco said construction should be done in phases to limit parking impacts.
We have to have a rock solid plan for interim sort of mitigation for parking when that happens.
The council also agreed aerial transit concepts should be separated from Main Street and Sweet Alley upgrade plans. Depending on where towers are built, the gondola could cost between $33 and $55 million. Declining visitation spurred the council's interest in revitalizing the Main Street core. A staff report shows total trips to the area held steady around 4.5 million in 2019 and 2021, with a sharp decline in 2020 during the COVID-19 pandemic. Visitation has gradually declined since 2022, with about 4.17 million people on Main Street in 2025. That's 9% below peak numbers. Spending per visit, adjusting for inflation, has also declined. The council hopes redevelopment will bring more people to Main Street as Old Town sees increasing competition for visitors. Sirocco said making Sweet Alley more attractive will help.
How could they complement Main Street and help create, you know, more stickiness in that Main Street core area for visitation and also more attraction in terms of reasons for people to come?
City staff will have more detailed plans, timelines, and financial analyses for the council in a few months. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The August 1st Utah Water Availability Update from the Natural Resources Conservation Service's Utah Snow Survey Report gives a strong opportunity to distinguish rainfall conditions from actual water availability. While July's monsoonal rains improved our soil moisture and fire conditions, it did little to reverse the water supply deficit created by last winter's poor snowpack. On the phone to tell us more, I have Jordan Clayton. He serves as the Snow Safety Data Collection Officer for the NRCS. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's start with the big picture. What does the latest water availability report tell us about the state situation right now, and how concerning is it?
Well, it's pretty concerning. There's some pretty standout areas of the state that have depleted water availability. We knew this was coming because of the record poor snowpack that we received last winter, and that's where we get by far the majority of our water supply in the state. As you correctly mentioned at the top of the show there, the rain that we received definitely helps with our mountain soil moisture and reduces fire risk, and there's some great benefits to that monsoonal moisture, but it really doesn't do much to fill our reservoirs, and that's kind of a key difference that we like to highlight in those reports.
Yeah, any idea how much of that deficit from this dry winter that we're kind of carrying into late summer?
Well, the numbers are monthly, so it's a little hard to project what the end of August will look like, but based on August 1st, the majority of Utah's basins were in around the 20th percentile or below for water availability, with several in the bottom fifth percentile. So, in other words, there's a bunch of areas of the state where we haven't seen conditions like this 95% of the time or worse. A couple really jump out. The Sevier Basin in particular is an area where we've received, even with this above normal monsoonal moisture that we've received, which, again, does serve its benefits, some of the areas of the Sevier haven't been hit as much in terms of our summer rains. It looks like the month-to-date August precipitation for that basin is also below normal, even though its neighboring basins have been doing well. And then the reservoir storage in the Sevier is really low. We're talking bottom 10% of normal and in some cases less than 10% of capacity in some of those large reservoirs. So it's definitely an area of concern. You know, every year we use the water in ways that it's meant to be used, which is for agriculture and municipal purposes and all the things that we use water for. And we sort of assume that we're going to receive something in the range of normal snowpack to help replenish our supply. And that works in many cases, but if we get back-to-back really poor snowpack seasons, there's some areas of the state that are really going to be in a challenging situation.
Yeah, and kind of snowpack holds it on the mountain. I mean, you know, we keep hearing about this super El Nino, and that could mean, yeah, great snow. It could also mean lots of rain. So how does that separate, you know, what you do? Snowpack is better, rain is helpful?
Yeah, it really complicates things because what we do is we rely on that, as you said, the storage of that water, if you will, on the mountain in the form of snow. And then we make predictions, as does the Colorado Basin River Forecast Center. Both agencies make predictions for how much water we're going to receive when all of it predictably melts in the spring. But if it's not as predictable, if we're getting more midwinter runoff, then that modeling process is not really well set up for modeling midwinter flows and understanding how much water has been depleted from the snowpack during those midwinter losses. And if we accumulate less snow because some of it's rain instead of snow like we saw last winter, then we really are in a challenging situation. That was one of the interesting features of last winter, particularly around the turn of the calendar year. End of December, beginning of January, we received several really large storms, and it was a good system for precipitation, but there were such warm events that even at high elevations that was coming down as rain instead of snow, and that has caused our water year precipitation numbers all year from, you know, they started in October and they ended the end of September, and all year things have looked pretty good. Right now, this day is at 91% of normal precipitation, which sounds pretty positive. But a lot of that had to do with, again, early October rain and then those midwinter rain events that weren't snow. And that's been a little bit of a messaging issue in terms of talking about our water supply.
Okay, yeah, the water year goes from like October 1 to September 30th.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. Well, for those of us living along the Wasatch Back, can you talk to us about the numbers and what do they tell about the water supply in our northern Utah watersheds?
Yeah, it's been interesting. We've actually received, again, above normal. July was great for our monsoonal moisture. We received above normal moisture in most areas of the state. Same is true for August, except for a couple areas right around Park City, like the Thames Canyon. Snowtall site is actually received less than 50% of normal August precipitation. The Milby North Snowtall site is at about 75% of normal, and that's just the character of these monsoonal storms where they can be very localized and hit certain areas more than others. There's a couple of other areas of the state, but we're focusing on the area around Park City, but I'd be remiss if I didn't also mention, like, southeastern Utah, only about 50% of August precipitation. Again, the severe basin, a little bit low. Mm. When we get into what that means for water availability, you're in the headwaters of the Weber right there, close to the headwaters of some other basins, but the Weber as a whole is listed as having about the 10th percentile for water availability as of the beginning of August. And so certainly we're really concerned because what that says is that the amount of stream flow combined with the reservoir storage in that basin has been better 90% of the time than what we observed at the beginning of the month. And so we were able to compare water supply conditions based on the historic record, and that's what things were looking like for the Weber. Similar for the Provo, about 14th percentile for water availability. Definitely in a lot of room for improvement.
Mm. And are we seeing unusually low stream flows in both the Weber and Provo River systems? And I guess what does
that
mean?
We are. Yeah, we are. That was also predictable. I mean, this is a time of year where we typically don't have a lot of flow anyway. But certainly we think of the August through July period as that main period for receiving all the bulk of our runoff from our snowpack. And then later in the summer, we get into August, things can spike a little bit when we get these monsoonal events that can cause the rivers to kick up in terms of their discharge. But usually there's not a ton of flow. That being said, the area around Park City still has received below normal runoff for the month so far. So for example, the East Canyon Creek near Jeremy Ranch is at about 57% of normal for its monthly flow as of today. When you get a little farther down in that stream near Morgan, it's about 52%. So I think you get the idea. Rockport Reservoir inflow is definitely below normal for this time of year. So not seeing flows that were in the range of normal, and again, that was what we anticipated. And then this is also an interesting time of year because we make these April through July flow predictions from our snowpack. Once July ends, we can then look back and compare how much actual stream flow we received relative to what was predicted. And we can start to dive into that a little bit now as those numbers are coming in. And it looks like some areas of the state, we actually underpredicted. Things did a little bit better than we anticipated, which would be like the south slope of the Uinta Mountains. Some of those rivers did pretty well. But if, again, we zoom in by Park City, some areas along the Wasatch Front, the streams didn't flow as much as we had hoped, even based on the very skeptical forecast that we had. So, for example, East Canyon Creek near Jeremy Ranch, well, when we look at that total volume, April through July flow, we got about 25% less than we predicted, which is not the worst prediction in the world, but when we compare it with some of the other streams, like Mill Creek near Salt Lake City, about 30% less than we expected. Emigration Creek near Salt Lake City, almost 100% less than we expected. And this is one of the things that we were concerned about. It gets back to the topic I mentioned a few minutes ago. When we get all this midwinter rain and early water year rain and some other conditions that were so unusual, very warm conditions last winter, it really is a challenge for our modeling system to take those April through July predictions and make them robust. And I think that came to fruit here, where some of the predictions, even as dire as they were, we actually still received less flow than those volumetric predictions suggested.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, you know, snowpack is Utah's water savings account, and we know much of that was depleted after this winter. So how difficult is it to rebuild it?
Well, part of that has to do with the soil moisture, which is looking positive. That's one of the great benefits of these monsoonal events, is that they put a lot of water up in our mountains in the ground. And when we have moist soils, that helps when we do ultimately get the snow melt the following spring. That helps a larger proportion of that snow melt make it efficiently downstream. There's not a lot other than temperatures that can really help, get our snowpack season going at this time of year. Certainly, we welcome those cooler temperatures when they are going to start coinciding with that snowpack. But we just have to hope for those late fall snowpack events to accumulate more than those Novembers have been in recent times. And we've noticed even with good snowpack seasons like 2023 and some of the other ones recently, November, their shoulder season, like November and April, have not been performing as much as we would hope. And so if we could get some more of that shoulder season snow before we get into the bulk of our winter, that'd be great, and that would help a lot.
Yeah, and you've run through a lot of your different measurements that you use for these monthly reports: snowpack, precipitation, soil moisture, reservoir storage, and stream flow. Which of those indicators, I guess, concerns you most right now?
Yeah, I think it would be the water supply in particular. So we can kind of wring our hands about what the snowpack might be like next winter, but we also can manage only a certain amount of that. There's certainly some very creative and successful ways to augment snowpack from cloud seeding, some other things, but the larger side that we have control over is what we do with the water once it fills our reservoirs. And that's the side of things that's, I think, concerning because of the low reservoir numbers that we're really seeing in many areas of the state.
All right. Anything in the current data that gives you reason for optimism?
Yeah, you mentioned El Nino. El Nino is not strongly correlated with Utah snow, but it does have a sort of a suggestive relationship. And particularly for southern Utah, southwestern Utah, it suggests that we'll have above normal midwinter precipitation. It also suggests that some of the valley locations might be warm, so it's not looking great for valley snowpack. I'm not sure that's good or bad news for people, depending on your perspective. But for mountain snowpack, the jury's still out, particularly for northern Utah, and we'll take the very strong El Nino signal with a glimmer of hope at this point.
Mm. All right. And in terms of what we've got going on, you know, just a significant snow deficit and then a summer with above normal temperatures. I mean, is this something you think that's going to become more common, or is this just an anomaly?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really hard to say. We don't really know at this point, of course, but one of the things that we are seeing in the data is I think everyone that's listening probably has experienced anecdotally, is there's a lot more year-to-year variability in our snowpack than we had even just 15 years ago. We can see, and it's statistically relevant when we compare the last 15 years with the previous 15 years, there's more interannual variability in the statewide snowpack, and it's also true locally, where we get these boom or bust cycles, which tended to be a little bit more of a distribution around the norm in the past. Obviously, we had big and small years in the past as well, but it's been pretty extreme, where 2023 we set records for the state snowpack-wise, and last winter we also set records for the state snowpack-wise in the opposite direction, and a lot of back and forth in between. So it's hard to manage when you get these back and forth winters like this.
Okay, Jordan, anything else you wanted to tell us about the report?
No, I'm going to be hoping for the best like everybody else with our snowpack, and I appreciate your time and interest in our data.
Okay, appreciate your time as well. Jordan Clayton is the Snow Safety Data Collection Officer for the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Thanks.
Thank you.
In the studio now with a look at some of the lodging data for early summer, I have Park City Chamber Bureau CEO Jennifer Wilsohoff. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's look at early summer. How did things look?
You know, the numbers that I have right now, the most recent for July, our Destinometrics data is showing that occupancy for July was down about 2%, just at about 43% average. ADRs at those average daily rates that we talk about a lot were up about 6% to $400 per room night. But what's really interesting is we have multiple data sources. So another lodging data source that we use is from Smith Travel Research, which is more of a moderate and the economy traditional hotel properties. And what's interesting is that for July, the data there shows that those properties, the occupancy was actually up 5%, and those average daily rates were up 5%. So what that's telling us is that there's really an affordability story happening right now, where consumers are looking for more affordable, more economic properties. We're seeing, like, when you compare those two data sets, the Destinometric properties, those average daily rates are at about $400. And for the other data set, that those average daily rates are about $300. So we're definitely seeing those economic factors impacting visitor decisions and traveler decisions. And I think I'm hearing that anecdotally too from our businesses on Main Street. It seems like the businesses really across town, those that have more economical, more moderate types of pricing are doing fairly well. It's the higher end that maybe aren't performing as well as those more affordable shops.
Okay, but if you do look at all last 6 months, it sounds like we are down.
Yeah, last 6 months down about 11% at 40% general occupancy. And again, those average daily rates are down about 2%. So, I mean, not really surprised that that's taking into account January, February, March, April timeframe, where we know what the snow situation was. So rather than looking back at this point, I think looking forward tells a much more positive story. Occupancy for the next 6 months on the books is actually ahead of pace, about 5%, which is really good news. And as we've talked about over and over, those rates are really starting to normalize. We're seeing for the next 6 months, rates are down about 6%. So again, I think we're starting to see some normalization of the market, especially after year of the last 4 out of the 5 years have been record-breaking tax collections. So starting to see some normalization in the marketplace.
Okay, and then what does this all mean? Because, of course, reservations translate into sales tax, lodging taxes, things like that.
Absolutely, and we look at those tax collections monthly. From the Summit County collections that we have the most recent data through July, again, that only represents May performance. So looking back, we know that May was a tough year. Or a tough month, seeing that restaurant taxes for May were down about 10%, transient room tax down double digits, about 19%, and recreation, arts, and parks tax down for May 6%. the shining light here was that still local sales taxes for that month of May were up about 4%. I think it's better at this point to look at the last 6 months or last actually 7 months of sales tax collections. Those sales tax collections for the year so far actually up about 4%. Restaurant taxes are down about 5%. And then those transient room taxes are also down about 8%.
Okay. Does that impact your budget at all?
Yeah. Yeah, it impacts our budget quite significantly. As you know, we have a contract with Summit County through the transient room tax collections. This time, you know, our board approved our budget for the last year, and unfortunately our budget's down over $1 million. So that meant significant cuts to a lot of our programming. Our staff was really thoughtful about protecting any of the funds that actually translate into visitor attraction. So really focusing on bringing those visitors back and then pulling back on some of the visitor education, some of the destination management, some of the stewardship that we focused on so much over the last couple of years as we were trying to balance a robust volume of visitation. So the good news is that we're adaptable and we're able to really pivot with where the community needs us. And right now, the community really needs us to be focusing on visitation and visitor attraction, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Did you have to lay anybody off?
No. Good. No, luckily no.
Okay. Let's see. The annual meeting is coming up, and that's when you will approve the budget, yeah?
Our budget got approved in June. Oh. We're on a fiscal year budget, so our new budget started in July. But annually, we do a membership meeting. This year will be held on September 3rd at the Pendry Park City from 9 to 11. And this is just our annual opportunity to talk to our members about what we've accomplished and the issues that we faced over the last year and then the plans for the upcoming year. One of the highlights of the event is also awarding the Miles Radiman Spirit of Hospitality Award. We're really excited to recognize someone in the community for that. Unfortunately, those tickets are already sold out. That event is sold out. If anyone is interested in getting on a waiting list, they can simply email us at membership@parkcitychamber.com.
Okay, we've got a new event coming to town, the Fox U.S. Open of Mountain Biking at Deer Valley Resort. I guess before we get into the details of that, I mean, how important is that for Park City to offer new events like this?
New events or events in general are a really important part of economic development. And, you know, I think smaller destinations really lean into events as a form of visitor attraction. And I think over the years in Park City, we've had this sort of pendulum effect of not enough events, too many events, not enough events, too many events, and really just trying to find this middle ground of using events as a way to elevate our values, the things that are important to us, like our winter legacy, our snow sports legacy, our outdoor adventure, our arts and culture, our sustainability initiatives. And I think over the last couple of years, we've shifted a little bit away from events as a form of economic development. And what we're seeing now is, at least our organization believes, that it's time to lean back into events as a way to really grow or even maintain our tourism economy. So these events are really important. 2 weeks ago, 2 weekends ago, we had our first inaugural Chef's Table Festival, which we were really proud to partner with Chef's Table and Netflix and American Express to bring that event here. We brought in over 70 world-class chefs to partner with our local chefs as a way to elevate our culinary arts. Really excited about that event. Our chefs were working with, you know, elbow to elbow in their kitchens with some of the world's best chefs, learning from them, collaborating with them, and sharing that they're cooking with these amazing worldwide chefs. So we're really leaning into culinary tourism. In fact, later this week, we have our Michelin event in Las Vegas, where we've participated with Salt Lake and Sundance Resort as a way to open the door to Michelin. We are part of a Wasatch Culinary Collective, where now Michelin will be doing a chapter on our area in their book. And hopefully we'll also get named to have a chef or a restaurant or two named to the Michelin recognition. So this is a way for us to really elevate the arts in that way. And then leaning into the outdoor recreation, this Fox US Open mountain biking event at Deer Valley, September 11th through the 13th, is just a way to lean into our mountain biking, lean into our summer and fall, where we really do need business. And then the following weekend, we have the UCI Mountain Bike World Cup at Soldier Hollow September 19th to the 20th. So really looking at these brand pillars, what types of events can really elevate and help put Park City on the map in these different areas.
Yeah, and especially outside of those busy summer months.
Exactly.
Yeah. Back to that Chef's Table Festival, though. I mean, was it a tourism generating, or did we see a lot of people even just coming from Salt Lake and local?
We don't have the numbers yet. I think most importantly, it was a very small event. Mm-hmm. So if it moves the needle in terms of occupancy, it would be great. That isn't really the major reason why we supported it this first year. It's just the opportunity to garner the media and the content that came out of the influencers who were here during that time, and for us to be able to connect our chefs and our storytelling and our Utah agriculture and spirits with that sort of credibility. I mean, most of the visiting chefs, if we added up their media influence, we have millions and millions of followers, of fans who care about culinary and care about food. So I think it was a really wonderful first year event. We look forward to hosting it in the future.
Okay, and then this Fox Mountain Bike Downhill race, over 3 days, you're expecting like 10,000 people.
Yeah, that's what Deer Valley is anticipating, over 10,000 attendees over those 3 days of competition.
Okay, and you've got another Wasatch Back Business University lesson coming up.
We do. The topic of that event is Get Found First. It's local website optimization, SEO, and Google business tools. That's going to be held on Wednesday, September 2nd at 11:30. If you're interested in registering for that, you can just check out parkcitychamber.com.
All right, and other upcoming events?
I'll just also reiterate on the back-to-back mountain biking events, September 11th, the Fox Open, September 19th, the UCI Mountain Bike World Cup. We're hearing from Soldier Hollow that they believe that event at Soldier Hollow is going to be their biggest event there since the 2002 games. So the good news about that is that these sorts of events really help us practice that muscle of how to produce big events in a way that we're managing traffic, we're managing volunteers, people moving, safety, security, all of these things that really help us practice in order to get ready for those 2034 games.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
One final note, just sending our deepest condolences to the loss and passing of Colin Hilton. Colin was an incredible friend and mentor and leader in our community, and his loss goes very deep in our community. We send out our deepest condolences to his family and friends, and especially the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation.
Okay. Jennifer Wesselhoff is CEO of Park City Chamber Commerce and Visitors Bureau. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, as part of the Song Summit lineup on Saturday will be an hour-long discussion titled A Discourse in Civility. It'll be held on the foundation stage at the Song Summit Village at Park City's Library Park. The two panelists will include U.S. House of Representatives candidate for the 1st District, Ben McAdams, along with Utah Valley University Associate Professor, author, and podcaster Greg Jackson. It'll be moderated by Park City Leadership Director Scott Van Hartesveld. Greg Jackson joins me now on the phone. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Okay. Well, you have a new book. It's called Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. So when you look at the political moment we're living through right now, I mean, how much of it is really been there, done that?
Well, I really believe that the vast majority, technology, of course, brings different iterations that feel very new to us. But when we look at our history, We see that everything from contested elections to political violence, fake news, none of these things are half as new as they feel to us.
Well, you do make an argument in the book that today's political turmoil is not as unprecedented as it can seem. Can you give us some of the stories to illustrate that?
Sure. One of the most visceral moments of violence that I encountered was in the build-up to the War of 1812, in which the two parties at the time, the Federalists and the Republicans, they clashed in what could only be called a street battle that ultimately ended in a massacre, with Revolutionary War veterans in one instance being killed, slaughtered with knives because he was affiliated with the quote-unquote wrong party. And perhaps to give an even more pointed example, let me take you to Louisiana of the 1870s, where a contested election over the executive office led to a clash at the Capitol that resulted in dead and an uncertain election.
Okay, so I guess, what do you think Americans most misunderstand then about how divided the country has been at other points in our history?
I think we've forgotten for the most part. We just haven't really studied our history or retained it. So many things we could get into about, what our curriculums are or how much emphasis we're putting on it. But to me, it's important to remember these very awful moments, not because we're wallowing in past failures, but that's how we remember that we have faced these sorts of challenges. And most importantly, it's not just about seeing that these things happened, but seeing the lessons that are in them. Well, what I certainly do not seek to do in this book at all is give some sort of Pollyanna take that just because we've had these experiences means that everything's going to be okay, but rather there are lessons in them for how we return to a state of greater stability and move forward as a nation.
Okay, well, what are some of those lessons then to move forward?
Sure. So one is that our institutions are stronger than we think they are. What I saw time and time again as I've dived into, whether it was political violence, it was egregious fake news, you name it, is that when it feels like our branches are ready to fold, when it feels as though the separation of powers are gone, they're often holding better than we think. That the infrastructure of the republic itself is quite stronger than it can feel when things are being pushed on. The other piece, though, is what the founding fathers would have called public virtue. And so we basically have a republic that's built to endure the worst of behavior, but it does depend upon some of us exhibiting our best behavior, what Lincoln would have called the better angels of our nature. And in each of these instances, whether we're talking about Lincoln during the Civil War or we're coming out of yellow journalism in which we have Pulitzer deciding that, rather than sell papers, I actually really want to be honest. And he sends out a memo to his entire company, the World newspaper in 1903. I'm quoting it, "There will be no faking." We do have to have Americans decide that they're going to behave on some level. That you can't have government by the people. It can't be we the people if the people aren't engaged. So that's the tension, institutions and public virtue.
Well, the media played a major role in some of the historical conflicts you've examined. I mean, what can the partisan press of the past teach us about today's highly polarized media and social media environment?
Well, first off, the idea that the press is going to not be partisan. We do have this illusion that that's not the natural state of things. And regretfully, what I see, looking all the way back to the 1790s, to the print wars between the founding fathers, that's the more natural state of things. I encountered a letter from Thomas Jefferson to James Madison, and I'm quoting Thomas Jefferson here. He's talking about Alexander Hamilton. He tells James Madison to, quote, "take up your pen, select some of his most damning heresies, and cut him to pieces in the face of the public." So, if we're going to get that from the founding fathers, who set up all the institutions that we hold in such high regards and rely on, I think we should probably accept that this is a bit of human nature. And yet, at the same time, I saw a few instances in which the American people really did hit their breaking point with enduring the worst of partisan presses. So that very same print war came to an end when Republican readers were so frustrated with their own press, when the National Gazette, which was the Republican paper of the day, put out an illustration of George Washington being beheaded by a guillotine. That was just too much for them. They stopped following the paper. The paper folded. So we have these moments where we see Americans choose to get on a better course.
So as I mentioned, you'll be participating in this Discourse in Civility Saturday about from 5 to 6 p.m. Is civility actually necessary for a healthy democracy, or can an emphasis on being civil sometimes prevent people from confronting serious disagreement?
Well, we'll talk about this, of course, in depth, but I don't think we should confuse civility with agreeing. Those are not the same thing. My mind goes to President Lincoln, who in his first inaugural address is calling on the nation to be friends, not enemies. He's saying this after states have already seceded. The first shots of the Civil War haven't been fired, but we have seven states that have seceded. Lincoln's not saying, come back and I'm going to give you what you want, but he is encouraging them, reminding them that we must not be enemies. And he's right. The choice to be enemies resulted in over 2% of the nation being dead over the course of the next few years. Civility is choosing to not turn to civil war.
So I guess what does genuine political civility look like? I mean, is it being polite, or is it something deeper?
No, it's something deeper. Certainly we can be polite. We should be polite. But civility, I believe, also requires honesty. It does mean speaking your position. It means not holding back. But there's a difference between, again, the way, say, Lincoln didn't hold back, and yet everyone knew that, he never lost his cool, and yet he could still express very deep, meaningful, and firm positions. That's what moves the nation forward.
So also joining us in studio here, Ben Anderson, director of Song Summit. Ben, why was this something that you wanted to add to Song Summit? I mean, what has this got to do with music?
Yeah, good morning, Leslie, and good morning, Greg. I'm looking forward to having you this weekend. In a world where we seem to be more and more divided, I think that what Greg just brought up is important, is that there is one thing to be civil, there's another to be uncivil, there's another to take disagreement to the point of violence and death, and to really divide us into enemies. So one of the things that Song Summit, I co-founded in 2019, was around the idea that sometimes we are afraid to talk about those things in our society that make us feel uncomfortable. Politics is one of them, and the issues regarding politics. Another one is things that are going on in our society. It is very difficult and uncomfortable for us to talk about things like mental health crises and suicide and chemical dependency and leaving the least of us behind and, the measures around diversity, equity, and inclusion. These have become, lightning rod issues. So one of the things about, Song Summit and why I was interested in having Ben McAdams and Greg come and talk is because Song Summit is much more than just a music festival. It always has been, and more than music has been our tagline since day one. because as we gather around the healing power of music, we notice that that's just the body of the octopus is wanting to gather together through community and have better connection and to actually lead with love. You know, those things that sounded so hokey when we were kids are so simple, and they're tried and true principles. And so if we can lead with love, we can still disagree. We can still say, I don't know that I agree that X amount of dollars should go to mental health or social justice or whatnot. But discourse is the only way that we get there. So what do we do at Song Summit? Labs have always been our special sauce, Leslie, as you well know. That is the thing that is our differentiator. That's the thing that caused Fortune Magazine to call us an unfestival. And I loved that. That was the greatest compliment, because festivals have turned into something that has become more trite than traditional. And it's, you know, just music with Instagram moments and making sure, you know, you're stepping over parental mistakes while you're going to the Doritos stand for, you know, more bad things to put in your body. So what we do is we say, great, if you want to come, we want to come and connect you around the issues that are affecting us all. And one of those that's affecting our mental health is the current political environment, and no less so than as we lead up to the midterms. So when people pick up their phones, oftentimes they doom scroll, and it's not hard to do it. Just open it up. But one of the things we suggest is, instead of just opening up the phone this Friday and Saturday when you're coming to a Song Summit here in Park City, and you're going to the free, I made it free this year, free Song Summit Village hosted by the Song Summit Foundation. That is from 11 to 7 at Library Field. Dog park, we call it, right? Right next to the library, where these labs are going to be held inside, and where Professor Jackson and Senator McAdams will get together. And we will discuss these things that are affecting us. All of it comes back to kindness, connection, and you can be kind in politics. You can do it without chopping George Washington's head off. You can do that when it comes to issues, you know, and no one's going to get their head cut off. I'm going to promise you that this week. I can't promise much, but that's what I'm going to put that out there, Leslie. But we wanted to have this discourse because the tentacles of mental health and wellness in our communities, one of those tentacles is music, using music for that platform, and using film, as you well know, our culinary actions that we're doing, that can, of course, bring in mental health issues, because so many people don't have food access and microeconomies around good, healthy food sources. But politics is also one that is driving, and I would just say the climate, our social climate has been completely entangled now with what we have always called during our lives politics. Like, what is politics, you know, and how does that affect us? And how can we try to utilize that at Song Summit as this community comes together and hears from leaders and professors and experts and thought leaders around the idea of, we can do this without another civil war. But how do we do it? It generally comes back to things like understanding and remembering our history and drawing upon it so that we can avoid things like that, and we can come together and actually disagree on things without, you know, violence in the streets.
Okay, so again, this is happening Saturday, 5 to 6, at the Song Summit Festival at Library Field. So people don't need a ticket. They can just show up.
Made it free this year. Okay. You know, even though a lot of your tax dollars out there you're listening to went to events that were not Song Summit Foundation or not Song Summit, why that keeps happening, I do not know. But events that have not even occurred yet got, you know, almost $200,000, some of them, of your tax dollars. So we don't return a cold shoulder or a slap with a slap. We return it with a hug. And so I said, you know what? Even though the county and the city were unable to give us money this year and others were deemed more worthy, I believe we're worthy, and this community, a lot of them, believes it's worthy. So you know what we did? Instead of doing the cold shoulder back to the community, we embraced it, and we said, you know what? We'll make this free. So we're using our own dollars and the donor dollars of the people that will hopefully show up, and they will be able to see things and hear things for free. And we are bringing this through Song Summit Foundation and Park City Song Summit to this community. But we're doing this so that you'll show up. So please do, 11 to 7 this Friday and Saturday at Song Summit Village, which is Library Field. Come down. There's going to be food, music, conversations like the ones that Leslie and Greg have been discussing, and celebrity chef activations, and 501c Village, and come hug a puppy. I mean, who doesn't want to hug a puppy and talk about politics, Greg? I mean, come on, for real.
That's the best way to do it.
I'm about out of time, but... you do have a fundraising, a foundation fundraiser happening Wednesday night. Do you still have tickets available to that?
Yes, and if they can just reach out to Ben@songsummit.com. I'll put them in touch with Frank and Paige and all the great people at the foundation who are doing good work. Please come support us. We've been supporting and going through this community since 2019, trying to, you know, bring goodness and connection and wellness and normalcy and clarity around issues like dependency and mental health and social justice. We're showing up. We can't keep doing this unless you show up. So we hope you'll see us. Yes, Wednesday night, reach out. And if you have any questions about tickets or anything like that, maybe you've got a group that wants to go to some of our labs on Friday and Saturday. Our labs are next level, and they're in Jim Santee. They start at noon each day. There's only three each day. And the first one is the Chef Andrew Zimmern starting this Friday at noon. Reach out to Ben@songsummit.com. If you want to bring a group, we will make it to where you can come in. No price point is too small for us to make sure you're at those labs.
Okay. Ben Adams, Greg Jackson, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.